I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Dr. Ian Douglas Hamilton. He's a zoologist from Oxford University. He's founder of Save the Elephants, which can be found at savetheelephants.org. And he has been researching elephants and campaigning for their survival for over 40 years. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Cafe.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
How did you begin studying elephants?
I actually wanted to study lions, but somebody very well known called George Schaller was coming to the same place to study the lions, and I was given elephants as a sort of compensation. But once I started studying them, and I studied them as individuals, I based my whole methodology on getting to be able to recognize individual wild elephants and look at their population dynamics and their behavior. Once I started, I couldn't stop, and they remained a fascinating source of study for me for the rest of my life.
What was it about them that fascinated you once you got to know them?
It's everything from their size and dexterity with that extraordinary implement, the trunk, to the obvious signs of intelligence and cognition. They very often appear to deliberately be absorbing facts and then acting upon them. But I really loved the way they treat each other. I was fascinated to unravel their basic social organization, to discover that they're a matriarchy, and that some of the relationships between the mother and their children can last for scores of years. They have very long-lasting bonds. They have tight-knit families. They're altruistic. They defend each other. And they have a whole load of characteristics which are rather similar to human characteristics, but arrived at from such an utterly different evolutionary origin.
Like, what's an example of that?
I think the way that the young learn from their parent is an example. They have very slow-growing brains. They reach puberty at about the same age that we do.
Which is unusual in the animal kingdom.
It's unusual for mammals to be as long-lived as human beings and elephants. Of course, chimpanzees are too, and they're also very intelligent. But the elephants have a system of leadership in where the matriarch, who's in charge of a family, acts as the main decision-maker and also the repository of knowledge, spatial knowledge, knowledge about what's safe, what's dangerous, what foods to eat. And the young learn from her example. They also have a range of emotions that, again, are uncannily like human beings. They seem to experience rage, compassion, and they have an extraordinary behavior towards their own dead, which is something I've particularly been looking at over the years. When I first started, it wasn't really known beyond a few hunters' and filmmakers' tales, but it is now well known that elephants will respond to other dead elephants, even to ones that are not related to them. And they will come and investigate a dead elephant. They'll, if it's a dying animal, they will exhibit all sorts of examples of compassion. A completely unrelated elephant may come to the aid of one that is faltering and is obviously sick, may come and prop it up or pull it back onto its feet. It's quite dangerous for elephants if they get so sick that they actually collapse. It seems that the other elephants appreciate this and they want to get a sick elephant back on its feet, which in many cases, I'm sure, will save its life. So they have a lot of characteristics that we can empathize with immediately.
And so as you watched them when you were starting out and you got to know them individually, are their personalities as different within an elephant, say family or clan, as they are among us?
Very much so. You have the bold and you have the timid. You have the leaders, you have the followers. You have animals that are excitable and ones that are pretty and easygoing. So those are obvious characteristics which are probably to some extent inherited. And you see the difference in their day-to-day lives.
Do they have what we might call cultures?
That's a difficult one. Certainly in different parts of their range, they behave in different ways, which are often dictated either by the safety or danger of their situation or by the condition of their habitat and range. So desert elephants behave in a distinct way where they're then adapted to the desert. And they they tend to travel much longer distances in search of water. And it's difficult to say if that's true culture, because culture's got to be learnt from your parents. Well, I suppose they do learn their range. I don't think that quite qualifies as culture, though. In terms of responses to danger, elephants will behave to human beings very much as human beings behave to them. So if human beings are aggressive and if they kill or injure elephants, the elephants will react with fear or aggression and in turn become very difficult to look at. So I see this all the time when I travel across their range. In the places where they're being harassed, they become almost completely nocturnal. They'll hide in the bush by day and come out to drink only at night. But where we live and work, which is in the north of Kenya, in an idyllic national reserve called Samburu, we find the elephants are very, very used to us and cars, and they will actually pay us a compliment of ignoring us and going about their normal daily behavior, literally coming up to within a few paces of the car and just carrying on.
Have any of them actually gotten to know you? I mean, do they say the elephant equivalent of, like, oh, hi, Ian?
Yes, they have. And there was one elephant in particular that I knew well. It was years ago in my first study when I was still fresh out of university. And there was an elephant I called Virgo. It was a very curious elephant. And she used to come closer to the car than any other, and she would inquire with her trunk sniffing around me. And eventually I started leaving the car and walking with her, and eventually she accepted me on foot, which was one of the greatest thrills of my life. But since those days, which were in the 60s, I haven't done it again, because there's too much of a risk that other people would see what I was doing and put themselves in harm's way.
Right.
And, of course, it was against the rules of the national park. You're not allowed to walk out with an elephant, even if you're a scientist studying one.
It must have been such an amazing feeling, though, to have what I suppose you could call an elephant friend, even if it was just once for a short time.
It really was, and I've always dealt with wild elephants. I haven't dealt with ones that are domesticated or tame or orphans that one brings up from the wild. But it's obvious that elephants form very strong bonds with their keepers, whether it's in a zoo or a circus or a little rescued elephant that has been pulled out of the wild and has been rehabilitated and will eventually be re-released back into the wild. You can have a strong bond between a human being and an elephant in those cases. It's usually a very tactile bond, a lot of touching going on.
Are elephants easily domesticated?
The Indians have been doing it for literally thousands of years, and African elephants are essentially no different. Hannibal, when he walked across the Alps, had African elephants, so he knew how to domesticate elephants. And there was a whole culture in ancient times across northern Africa and stretching down the Nile of catching and taming elephants. So it can be done, and the bonds can be long-lasting. In those days, they used elephants for war rather than the role of a tank, and they would smash through a body of infantry, and happily that's all come to an end now.
We're talking to Dr. Ian Douglas Hamilton, founder of Save the Elephants. Now, what kind of habitat do elephants thrive in, and how big does it have to be for a sustainable, what is the group, clan or?
Well, family is the basic unit, yes, the family unit, which will be a mother and her immature offspring. And in some cases, the mature females who choose to stay with her all their life until she dies. So the basic unit will be about 8 to 15 animals, and it may extend right down to grandchildren and great-grandchildren.
And they live in extended families.
They live in extended families. And it's actually quite subtle, because in these days where there's a terrible lot of poaching of elephants for ivory, there are many families that become quite disrupted. And once the matriarch has been killed, if you're just an immature elephant, your chances of survival are quite low. You don't really have the knowledge to survive. And of course, if a calf is young enough, it won't even have milk. It has to have milk in the first 3 years of its life, so they'll die. But these families, these orphan families, sometimes join up with intact family units. And it's a fascinating process that we've only recently began to understand. But in the place which is our chief workplace, it's called Samburu, we have a research center there which uses local people who are nomads to study the animals again, knowing each individual. And there we've been able to trace a fascinating process, rather sad process in a way, because we had a lot of poaching recently. And with the disrupted families, we've been able to watch how survivors have been able to enter into other alien families.
So it's like foster children or adopted children.
And like foster children or adopted children, the same set of problems. That biological tie isn't there. It's something that has to be developed through behavior. And very, very often you'll see that a lonely young female who's been orphaned will approach an intact family, and she'll sort of tag along and maybe take years to get accepted. But when she gets accepted, she finally makes the grade. And to an outside observer, you would not be able to know that she was not a biological member of that family, because she becomes totally integrated and moves in unison and has the same altruism of common defense, and she looks as if she's been born to it.
So what is their habitat like? What do they need in order to thrive?
Elephants in Africa can live in very varied conditions, from almost desert, as you find in Mali, where we've been tracking elephants using radio tracking gadgets, through to very thick equatorial rainforest. You find them down at the sea level in the mangroves, and you find them right up at the snow levels of Mount Kenya and Mount Kilimanjaro. Now, in between, it may be savanna or mixed bushland, all sorts of habitats. And sadly, one of the habitats they particularly like are human crops and farmlands.
Ah, yes.
And of course, the elephants think that these have been planted for them.
Right.
But where elephants' crops coincide, there's always conflict, whether it's in Africa or Asia.
Is there any way to keep an elephant out of your field?
There are many ways of keeping elephants out of fields. And our group, Save the Elephants, has actually invented a new way. We found that elephants are quite scared of bees. You get honeybees occurring naturally throughout Africa. In America, they're known as Africa killer bees, because they've hybridized with your own native bees here, and they're quite aggressive in America, and so they are in Africa too. So if a hive gets disturbed, there's a very angry buzzing noise that comes, and the bees swarm out and they'll sting whatever large mammal they can find, even an elephant. And surprisingly, even elephants have vulnerable areas, particularly around the eyes and the mouth and any of their orifices. So we learned a few years ago that elephants tend to keep away from swarms and hives of African honeybees. And we then invented, I have a young colleague, Lucy King, who wrote a thesis about this at Oxford, about how to construct beehive fences. And she's created these strings of beehives which are linked together with a wire. And if an elephant comes and tries to push by, it will jiggle the wire and the bees will start swarming and making the angry noise. And we found the elephants keep off.
Does it also provide honey for the people who have those fences?
Well, this is why it's a win-win situation, because normally it's very difficult to get communities to pay to create fences that are elephant-proof. But if they're actually maintaining a string of beehives, they've got free honey coming in as a reward, whether or not the elephant fence works, so they tend to look after it.
Do elephants migrate seasonally?
Where elephants are unfenced, they tend to migrate seasonally. Unfortunately, a lot of elephants in southern Africa are ring-fenced. They're quite often on small plots of private land, and by small I mean already several thousand acres.
But that's small for elephant range.
That's small for elephants, because elephants would like normally to have about minimum of 300 square kilometers, which is a big area. And they may go up, as in Mali in the desert, they have ranges that go up to 30,000 square kilometers, which is vast. So, yes, elephants are migrating across this. And wherever there are no fences, elephants do migrate. They choose areas for particular reasons. They choose areas that are full of the right kinds of food, but also which are safe. And this increasingly is the tendency that we see, that elephants learn quite quickly where's dangerous, where's safe. And to get from one safe haven to another, they have this behavior we call streaking, which is a very rapid unidirectional movement, usually at night. We've seen this again and again. We discovered it first when we were doing our advanced radio tracking. Now we know exactly where the corridors are and the places that the elephants like to streak at night.
What do they eat?
Very widespread in what they eat. There's hardly anything that they don't eat.
So they're total omnivores?
No, they don't eat meat. They're vegetarianivores, if you like. They go right across the vegetation spectrum. And there's certain poisonous plants they won't eat, but they're very few.
So they eat the leaves off the trees and fruits and...
They eat leaves, fruits, tiny little pods, seed pods that they pick up one by one, if necessary. And they have this amazing reach with their trunk. They can pick up tiny objects on the ground, or they can stretch 20 feet up into the air. That's one of the reasons that makes them such a successful species.
Tell us more about their trunks, how they use this, what is it, appendage?
Appendage, muscle? Yes, it's a unique appendage. It's a very mobile, prehensile, an extended nose. Very highly enervated, it's extremely sensitive. It can be used as a snorkel. If they walk under the water, they can breathe through it. It can be used to sift the air for very light odors that are floating across the breeze. And of course, they have a superb sense of smell. They have a whole range of sensations that we can't even comprehend. They have huge olfactory lobes to their brain that are purely devoted to analyzing smell. And then, of course, mechanically, it's an extraordinary instrument. It can pick up water and splash. They actually use it habitually for drinking. So they use the siphon. If they go down to any tiny little pool, they don't have to bend their head down. They just put their trunk down, siphon some water up into the trunk, and then they tilt their head back and they put the tip of their trunk into their mouth and let the water flow in through their mouth. But I think when it comes to food, they can break entire branches down with the trunk. Of course, they can push a little tree over as well if it's small enough, which they do, particularly the bull elephants. They can lean against a tree and push the base of their trunk against it and start rocking it until eventually it splinters and the roots break and down it goes. Now, when a big bull does that, very often the foliage will have been above trunk height, but then as soon as it comes down to ground level, an entire family may come in and join that bull and feast off this wonderful opportunity that he's presented everybody with.
How do elephants interact with other animals in their habitat?
On the whole, elephants are pretty tolerant, but the young ones do tend to play a lot, and they will chase antelopes, and they'll be very curious about everything living that they find. But they're also nervous animals, so they will... particularly little bulls, they'd be aggressive and start chasing things and putting their little ears out and making high-pitched trumpets and chasing them out of the way. But sometimes, when small creatures stand up to them, they're completely taken aback. And I've actually seen a little plover, which was a few inches high, defending its nest against a full-grown bull elephant that was advancing on it.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
The plover won. The elephant backed off. But elephants will react angrily and aggressively to anything that threatens them. So if they find lions on the ground, habitually they will form up and charge and chase the lions away. I've seen them chase them up trees. I've seen interesting things happen with crocodiles as well.
Really?
I once watched a bush on the edge of a river, and there was a crocodile in it, and there was a young elephant that came, and was fascinated, could see that there was something in the bush, and started probing around with its trunk. And eventually, the crocodile bit its trunk, and it gave out a tremendous squeal. And then all the other elephants came charging down, and actually the crocodile stood its ground for a bit, and they were unable to dislodge it.
It was clamped onto the elephant's trunk?
Not clamped. Not like the old story in the Just So stories of Kipling. But I've known that to happen. I've seen pictures where a croc has actually grabbed an elephant by the trunk and been pulled right out of the water.
What happened in that moment that you saw? What happened? Did the crocodile back off?
Well, the crocodile backed off and it retreated deeper into the bush. It's not quite what you expect to happen. You'd actually expect them to run for the water, but it was a little way from the water. And the elephants thrashed around for a while, and then they left it.
Now, do any animals prey on elephants?
Yes. And it's in certain parts of Africa that lions prey on elephants, particularly in Botswana. They first of all have to get an elephant that's alone, and preferably a young elephant. So if it's young or half-grown, some determined lions can actually eventually wear the elephant down so that it collapses and they kill it. But it's a horrible, long, drawn-out process. But in Botswana particularly, where they have sometimes huge lion prides and where the lions have learnt to kill elephants, you might even say it's a culture. It's a common practice down there that they will attack elephants en masse. And you may have as many as 20 lions all chasing one elephant, catching up, leaping all over it, trying to bite it, wherever. But it's difficult for them. And if the elephants stick together in a family, there's absolutely no way that the lion can penetrate.
We're talking to Dr. Ian Douglas Hamilton, founder of Save the Elephants. When you started studying elephants, that was in Kenya?
No, it wasn't. It was in northern Tanzania.
What was the land like where you were studying compared to how it is now in the various places you've studied? Because obviously elephants, as probably everybody listening to this program knows, are in big trouble, and part of that has to do with habitat loss and poaching and things like that.
When I first came to East Africa in the 60s, there were far fewer people than there are today, and the habitats in general across countries were in much better shape. So wherever you have elephants, they have a big problem of finding safety, which they find mainly inside protected areas. So a feature of the protected areas in the 60s was that elephants were crowding into national parks and reserves and actually destroying the vegetation. It was known as the elephant problem in those days.
Too many elephants in too little space.
Too many elephants in too little space, pushing over the woodlands until in some places you had vast landscapes where the trees had been felled by the elephants and they were changing into grasslands. But the biggest changes that I've seen since I began on the areas outside the protected areas. There were huge wildernesses that had no status, special status, in the 60s that have now filled up with people. Everywhere where there's water or the possibility of some kind of agriculture, the spaces are filled up. So we've seen probably one of the most rapid increases in human population anywhere has taken place basically through human beings successfully raising families rather than through immigration. And the elephant range has consequently diminished. But in that same space of time, the numbers of elephants have greatly diminished. So while the human population has more than tripled or quadrupled, the elephants are at least half of what they were in the parts of East Africa that I know. In some places, they're 95% fewer than they were. In other words, they've been virtually wiped out of some places. Within the major national parks, you still have good numbers of elephants there.
Now, when they're wiped out because of human encroachment, what happens to the ones that are there? In other words, are they hunted? Are they driven away and there's too many of them and they die of other causes? What happens?
Both those processes happen. They are both hunted and they are driven away. But the ones that have been eliminated more by the killing of elephants for ivory than they have been by competition with agriculture. Where there's intense competition with agriculture, the elephants will probably be driven away rather than killed off. And because they're very attracted to the high protein content of the human crops, they do come back. And unless you have a physical separation, they will take huge risks to come back and eat the crops, particularly bull elephants. Bull elephants, in order to pass their genes on, have to become bigger and stronger than other bull elephants. That means they've got to eat well, because when the time comes to mate, they're going to have to contest that right with other big bulls.
So they compete for females?
So yes, they compete for females, and by extension, they adopt a high-risk, high-gain strategy. They take big risks to eat well in order to be bigger than other bulls. Now, the females are much more risk-averse. They can survive on a protein-poor diet, and it's probably more important for them that they do survive and their families survive, rather than they take very high risks to become as big and strong as they might be eating human crops.
You said before that elephant societies were matriarchies. What does that look like?
What it looks like is you may be driving along and you see a group of elephants and you get a bit close in your car, and suddenly some huge elephant comes out and confronts you with her ears spread and trumpeting and doing a threat charge. Now, that will happen in many places where the elephants are not very well habituated. In other words, what it looks like is you have fearsome, large defenders of the family, and you better be careful if they think that you're a real threat.
Are they more that way? I mean, so many animals are particularly protective when they've got small children nearby.
Well, female elephants always have small children nearby. They're perpetual baby-producing machines. And every female group, if you see a group of elephants, you say, I wonder if those are bulls or cows. Just look for the babies. If they're females, they'll be there.
So let's talk about the current situation. We have a terrible problem, which is that there's a high demand for ivory and an ever-decreasing number of elephants. What are you seeing, and what is being done about it?
Well, what we're seeing is an eerie replay of what was an elephant holocaust in the 1970s and the 1980s. When I started my studies, we were in a sort of golden age of protection for the elephants, where the newly established national parks were thriving and tourism was growing and things were more peaceable in those days. As the 60s moved into the 70s, the price of ivory went up. And for a whole 2 decades, we saw the destruction of elephant populations in East, Central, West Africa and large parts of Southern Africa. That came to an end pretty much with an ivory trade ban that was instituted in 1989, when the nations of the world got together under this Convention of International Trade in Endangered Species, and they outlawed ivory, they made it illegal. And for pretty well 20 years, there was a ceasefire, at least in East Africa, and elephants began to recover. So we've been experiencing an extended recovery up till about 3 years ago.
What happened then?
Well, 3 or 4 years ago, the price of ivory once again took a sudden steep climb.
Why was that?
We think it was due to one predominant factor, that China came into the market. And China had loyally abided by the treaty decision not to trade in ivory. But they were also open and susceptible to arguments from the southern African countries who had large ivory stocks and well-protected elephants, that they wanted to sell their ivory. So under this treaty, they were permitted to sell their ivory stocks.
And so it was supposed to be ivory that was already there, not newly harvested
exactly.
Ivory?
But it seems that the effect of this was to open the market in such a way that the Chinese, from having been told all ivory is illegal, now the legal ivory was giving an excuse to people who were trying to sell illegal ivory. And so that the trade in illegal ivory soared, and it was supposed that when these stocks were released onto the market, that the price of ivory would drop. But it didn't. It actually soared. And what happened was that the Chinese government took the stocks of ivory and they actually doled them out in such small quantities that the price of ivory never did come down. So it seems that all that it did, that experimental sale, was to open the floodgates of demand. So now we're seeing a much, much higher demand, and it's reflected in the price. So what happened 3 to 4 years ago is that the price of ivory suddenly jumped up, and we've now seen that filter back to an increased level of illegal killing right across the continent. I've actually been measuring the level of illegal killing in our one particular population in Samburu and surrounding areas, where we have very precise data on how many animals are born and how many die, and what the number of carcasses are, and what proportion of those carcasses died naturally and what proportion died illegally. Now, all the indicators have jumped up to show that basically there's been a huge spike in illegal killing, and I'm afraid it's not a spike. I think it's turning out to be a higher plateau.
Is there any movement toward reinstituting the total ban on ivory trade?
Well, the total ban never stopped. What happened was that they just made an exception to a one-off sale of some quantities of ivory, and it had the effect of stimulating the market. But unfortunately, the parties to this treaty, if they wish, the elephant range states, they can submit a request to sell their ivory stocks. And every time this happens, it seems to have a bad effect on the demand, a bad effect on the levels of poaching. And right now, we're experiencing a crisis.
And of course, in China, there is a burgeoning middle class, and so there's a demand for all kinds of things. The same type of problem that you're talking about is happening in Asia with trade in all kinds of endangered species that are supposed to be useful in traditional Oriental medicine.
Yes, unfortunately, that's very true. That is Chinese prosperity and Chinese demand that is at the root of the present surge in killing elephants for ivory and many other species.
So just as there are responses to that, in other words, more guards in elephant reserves, there are also more killings, not only of the elephants, but of the humans guarding the elephants, and poachers have become very ruthless.
They've become very ruthless, and I think the solutions that we see include, of course, more guards and more better training and investment in anti-poaching. But the root cause has got to be to tackle the demand. I hate to single out China, but they are by far the largest source of illegal seizures. There was a very dramatic article in National Geographic which describes in great detail the demand from Asia. Some of this is actually related to religion.
How's that?
Well, curiously, in places like the Philippines, it is absolutely a custom to have all the religious statues made out of ivory. And equally, the Buddhists revere ivory. And I'm sure that neither of these religions ever spare a thought that actually every piece of ivory has to have a dead elephant. And there's a 90% chance that it's going to be of illegal origin, the ivory that comes in.
Are their leaders not aware of this?
They don't appear to be. And when it comes to China, where they have an ancient tradition of ivory carving, there is a profound lack of awareness of the consequences of buying. So part of our campaign now is to reach out and share our awareness with the Chinese and to try to persuade governments like the United States that they should take joint leadership with the Chinese at the highest diplomatic levels to solve this elephant problem.
Because that would be a lot more effective than guards against poachers, which is what it looks like on the ground level.
Guards on the ground against poachers are going to be necessary, and there the key has got to be in enlisting the support of the local people. But we're making headway in that in parts of Africa, but I'm afraid in other parts of Africa we're going to lose the elephant. And if we don't tackle the demand, we're going to lose the elephants very early from vast swathes of their range in Central Africa. Places like Zaire, the elephants used to number hundreds of thousands when I first started my Pan-African elephant survey back in the 70s. Now today, they're judged to be no more than a few thousands left, and those too could go unless there is better control. But in Zaire, where there's been a civil war and 5 million people have died in the last 10 years, it's very, very difficult to get anything meaningful done on the ground, and I admire the people who are trying to do it. I think we have a better chance in East Africa, in countries like Kenya and Tanzania. It's still going to be a very big struggle even there. And more recently in Central Africa, we've seen armed bands of militia coming from neighboring countries like, for example, Sudan, where you have the Janjaweed, who are horse-mounted, and they come and poach as far west as Cameroon. They actually wiped out half the population of one national park within a few days back in the first part of this year. It's one of the worst massacres that's been seen in 2 decades.
In so many ways, it sounds like the drug war. I mean, you can put all your money into trying to fight a war on drugs, but if there's a demand for drugs, somebody's going to supply drugs.
This is very true. And what happened in the early iteration, I told you there was a holocaust of elephants back in the 70s and 80s. That came to an end because demand in the West collapsed. And the reason it collapsed was spreading awareness about the effects of the killing and the cause, which was to buy ivory.
Now, does the Chinese government really care one way or the other about the plight of elephants, whether they be in Africa or Asian elephants?
Well, I went to China 2 years ago with my wife. And we went to view the last Chinese elephants. Yes, there are wild elephants in China living in a patch of forest near the Burmese border. What we found when we went there was a complete revelation that the Chinese honor and value their elephants in a way that's almost akin to the panda. The laws are extremely strict, and so is the enforcement. In former times, you would even get the death penalty for being caught killing an elephant. Now, it's a matter of a very, very long prison sentence. So, given that concern, it seemed to me that if the Chinese could translate that to Africa, which is a country that they're intensely interested in, it's a continent where they need and want the raw materials, where they spent a decade building up very close relationships with African governments and people. If they were aware, my hope is that they would change their behavior towards Africa's elephants and treat them rather like they treat their own.
Have you been able to meet with them?
We have. I've met with an NGO in China called the China Wildlife Conservation Association. They're composed of people who have close links to the official management of wildlife in China and to the officials who represent China at the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. We even brought them over to Africa. Some wonderful donors of ours from Indianapolis financed a team to come of the very people who'd hosted us in China and shown us the elephants. And they came back to Africa and we shared with them what we knew. We showed them the elephants live and we also showed them the elephants dead. And then recently, we had a very exciting project. We teamed up with a group called Wild Aid, who have been using Chinese celebrities to spread the message about not exploiting endangered species, not killing sharks for their shark's fin. And we brought over to Africa Yao Ming, the famous basketball player. We brought him to our place in northern Kenya, where my wife runs a wonderful camp called Elephant Watch, and he stayed there, and we brought him face to face with wild African elephants, very tame and habituated, very happy with their lives, playing with their children, and he was blown away by seeing these elephants, and you can see them as close as I am to you. It's one of the most wonderful experiences in the world. But we also brought him face to face with dead elephants, with their faces hacked off for the ivory, and he was profoundly shocked by this, and he wrote a beautiful blog in which he told everybody how he felt about seeing the elephants playing and interacting with each other, and then the horror of seeing these dead elephants. And he said he was absolutely speechless. He didn't want to repeat that experience ever again. And he carried this message in an English language blog, which you can find under yaomingblog.com, and he also translated into Mandarin, and it reached within days 800,000 Chinese people. So we hope that this is the first drop in the ocean towards changing consciousness in China. And what we learned was very interesting, that most of the buyers first don't think about where the ivory comes. And when they're asked, they say, oh, but surely this just comes from old animals who died naturally. Or isn't it true that elephants drop their tusks like the antlers of a deer once a year and you can just pick up the ivory? They did not know. And I think it's a matter of sharing this awareness. After all, in our own cultural history, we were pretty predatory towards the buffalo in North America, and we wiped out plenty of species on the continent of Europe too. So I don't think that being rapacious is particularly towards nature's any more Chinese than it is Western inherently. And I think if you can build up the feedback mechanisms of people being aware and caring about animals in the wild, we can only hope this is going to affect demand. And that's what we're aiming at the moment. We're campaigning, we're putting billboards in Beijing with this group called Wild Aid, and the motto is, if the buying stops, the killing can too.
What can ordinary American people do?
I think, first of all, they can be aware too. And, of course, we would love them to donate to save the elephants. And I am here trying to raise money to save elephants. We work with a group in San Francisco called Wildlife Conservation Network. Donations can be made through them. But I think if you can't donate, then be aware and talk to American representatives in Congress and make it an issue. It's got to be an issue or a large part of the elephant's going to go.
What happens to elephant habitats when there's no elephants? Do the ecosystem suffer?
It does. In parts of the forest, some of the trees rely on being spread by elephants in their dung. The fruit are consumed and the seeds are scattered across many, many miles distance. And in other places, the vegetation just chokes up, because the elephants are the great trail makers for many other species. In fact, in times of dry season or drought, they become the well diggers when the rivers subside and run below the sand. It's the elephants that dig up the holes and allow the other animals to come to drink. So in many ways, things will suffer. And not only that, but in the better developed areas, especially East Africa, communities have come to depend on elephants for their livelihood. They have ecotourism. The conservationists have brought security to their areas in some places which are volatile, where there's a lot of cattle rustling. Actually, becoming a conservationist can help you with your security in many different ways. And so the poachers are basically, they're not poor, suffering people whose crops are being destroyed. Those are not the people who kill elephants for ivory. They are freebooting criminals who have no social conscience. They're gangsters, and increasingly, sadly, organized crime is coming in to the movement of the ivory. It's now recognized by everyone that large containers cannot travel without some help from organized crime, and that is what's happening.
Do you see a shift in consciousness among human beings that the natural environment is something not to be exactly to be dominated, but rather to be interacted with and lived with? I'm not saying it quite right, but do you know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying. Our people are becoming more enlightened towards the environment. And I think there's certainly more people that are more enlightened, yes, and especially in America, and probably especially in Santa Fe. But the problem is that there are more people overall, and it's very difficult to stop development. You can only compromise with it. And I think our key in Africa, which badly needs development and is going to get development, is every time there's a highway, we need to come up with information that's going to mitigate whatever the human development is. Elephants this day live more than 50% of their time outside officially designated protected areas. So for that to continue, they have to compromise, we have to compromise with development. We have to meet human goals, and it can be done. So again, what Save the Elephants does is detailed monitoring of population dynamics of elephants, distribution behavior, and particularly movement behavior. We have very advanced high-tech radio collars we put on, and we've actually arranged that these can be viewed in almost real time on Google Earth. All the information from our radio collars goes straight into a database that sits up in a computer cloud, and if we give people the keys, they can then watch the elephants live, and we can also summarize the behavior patterns which can be made available to the government planners, all of whom are entirely ignorant, by the way. We can get in there first as scientists, and we can supply the information on how elephants make their choices and what the elephants need. And that is the core of what we're doing at Save the Elephants.
You actually were recently in Washington, D.C., talking to our government about this.
Yes, I went up to talk to some staffers, and Senator John Kerry then decided to hold next week a Senate Foreign Relations Committee that was going to look into the question of ivory and the global implications for security, ivory trade and poaching and how it affected security. And it was a great opportunity because I was able to point out the two main things that got to be done. One is to reinforce anti-poaching on the ground by using the communities, and then to go to the root cause of the matter, which is demand in the Far East. And I asked if the US government would please use diplomatic approaches at the highest level to raise the issue with the Chinese.
And did they do so?
Yes, Hillary Clinton apparently mentioned this issue of elephants and ivory. And I hope it was in the way of sharing awareness, because I think it's lack of awareness that is at the root of the problem in China.
Now, when people donate to SaveTheElephants.org or to World Women Work, which is an organization, a wonderful organization based here in Santa Fe, worldwomenwork.org, the money really goes straight to where it's needed.
Well, 100% of the money, without any deduction, will go into what we're doing in the field and worldwide, both to reduce poaching and to raise consciousness on what demand does and how it can be reduced.
Are you hopeful that elephants will be saved and that the poaching will stop?
Well, we've recovered from one Holocaust in the past, and I hope we're going to do so again in the future. And in the past, it was really won back by the fact that people became aware that they shouldn't buy ivory, and ivory demand dropped in the West totally. I hope that the same thing can happen in the Far East.
Dr. Ian Douglas Hamilton is a zoologist from Oxford University. He is the founder of Save the Elephants, which can be found on the web at SaveTheElephants.org. Thank you so much for being with us today on the Radio Cafe.
It's been nothing but a pleasure.